So the Saga project. So this is a more of an observational project, and the goal of the Saga project is to try and characterize luminosity functions, satellite luminosity functions, around 100 Milky Way-like galaxies. This was a project that was conceived by Risa Wexler and myself a really long time ago. We first started talking about this and started actively working on it about 6 or 7 years ago. Yaoyun Mao considered this for his thesis project. He's now ought to be, after yesterday's talk, should be scooped up for faculty sometime soon. It's a very small group. So this is Risa and Yao has been working on this. Eric Tollerite has been working on this quite a bit. Ben Wiener and Ben Hoyle also have to some extent. And then the Saga team is actually only like 3 other people. So it's a very, very small team, but we're trying to do something very ambitious. And it's a project that, in part, I started after having been working on the ultra-faint galaxies. This is 2007, 2008. Things were, you know, sort of Wild West. Things were going very fast, and I wanted a project that would be unscoopable. This is an unscoopable project. So just to preview what we've done, we have 20,000 redshifts that we've taken just kind of ourselves. And have characterized satellite luminosity functions around 8 Milky Way hosts so far, but our goal is to get to 100. The idea was conceived because we know that the Milky Way satellites, you know, we've seen them in every single talk this morning, are used as comparisons to simulations quite a bit, but we know that the Milky Way is a sample of one. And Risa and I were actually quite concerned several years ago, and it's come to fruition that there are more simulated Milky Ways down to the resolution of, like, say, 10 to the 6 stellar mass, then there are real Milky Ways out there. And we didn't see a way, in the next couple of years at least, that we would get more observed Milky Way luminosity functions. And so we decided to do this ourselves. And I think that is true. So this is the Saga survey, so satellites around galactic analogs. Saga, get it. And we have a really nice website. The survey paper is available on the website. And we just... Everyone says they just posted their paper. So we just posted to Astro PH 29 point, I didn't include my introduction, but 9.6 minutes ago. Yao actually did this on his phone. You can submit on your phone, which is absolutely stunning. So I was going to give an introduction, but I actually just don't think it's necessary. Why are the Milky Way satellites important? We've seen that quite a bit this morning. And as way of an introduction, I decided to just ask how many people in this room have published using the Milky Way satellites to compare to their simulations. And so I just kind of went through and figured that out. So if I look at this room, what am I? Yeah, don't raise your hands. I've already figured it out. So it's about it's about only 10 or 15%. And the problem is that there are many young people in this room. And so there's an age correction. If you guys wait 10 years, y'all will write papers comparing your simulations to the Milky Way satellites. And so if I age correct, looking at the list of speakers, that number goes up to about 2/3.
How do you age correct and trying to find how to do
the speakers that? Are older. The speakers are older. you're giving a talk. So it's 2/3 of the speakers have written papers using the Milky Way satellites as sort of an observational field post to compare to simulations. But we know that the Milky Way has just been drawn from, it's a single realization of a Milky Way mass halo. And so we want to try and rectify this. So what has been done in the past? So in order to find satellites around Milky Ways, you have to go out into the observational world. This has been done in the SDSS looking at LMC, SMC-like satellites around the Milky Way. And there was a flurry of papers in sort of 2011, 2012. Many different groups did this, asking if I look for Milky Way analogs, and we'll talk about what I mean by that. If we look at Milky Way analogs, what is the prevalence of an LMC and SMC around it? And you need the spectroscopic survey to identify satellites, and I'll explain why that's critical. So here are just a couple of Milky Way-like objects, and the satellites are circled, and just taking out of a random paper of this, so these are Risa's results, that if you look at the LMC-SMC, these are unusual for a Milky Way mass halo, but it's not really uncomfortable at this point, down to these masses. So it happens maybe something like 4% of the time. So maybe it's like a little fluctuation. And it's only below these masses, so below SMC, that things get funky. So the too big to fail problem really sets in at these masses. And so rather than get to SMC, we would like to push this at least an order of magnitude in stellar mass further. And in order to do that, we need a Sloan Digital Sky Survey that goes 2 or 3 magnitudes deeper. And that's obviously not going to happen anytime super soon. And so the SAGA goal is to characterize satellite populations around 100 Milky Ways. And we picked this number 100 just that if we just pick the Milky Way satellites out of a Milky Way halo 100 times, if you do that, you can start to actually say something about the properties of the underlying distribution. And this number, -12.3, is associated with our ability just to get spectra down to a certain magnitude limit. This corresponds to, in the Milky Way, 5 satellites you would expect in the Milky Way. So LMC, SMC, the disrupting Sagittarius, Fornax, and the faintest one would be LEO 1 that we find. So this is a stellar mass of about 10 to the 6-ish is going to be our satellite, our survey limit. Right, so we would expect, if we surveyed around 100 Milky Ways, we want to do this out to the Vero radius, so about 300 kiloparsecs, we would expect to find 5 satellites around the Milky Way. Excuse me. So first off, what is a Milky Way? And how should we define Milky Way? Actually, can I borrow somebody's coffee or something? I'm about to... Risa, can I borrow your coffee?
She's got one sip.
That's all I need. Thank you. Ah, okay. Thank you. I got it. I'm good. Okay, so how do we define a Milky Way? And I haven't put the rest of the slides up here because I want to think about what we're actually doing. Why are we focusing on the Milky Way? I would like to get satellite functions and group, catalogs for everything, not just the Milky Way, L-star galaxies, 10th L-star, for everything. And we just don't have the observational resources to do that. So we're focusing on a Milky Way mass halo, only it's sort of out of convenience, in part because we understand the Milky Way satellites quite well. But so what a Milky Way is, I don't want to necessarily match precisely to our Milky Way, but I want some definition that we can use both observationally and theoretically and be able to compare back and forth. And this is where the collaboration between Risa and myself was very, I think, productive in designing a survey that is implementable observationally and should be very useful in terms of comparing back into the simulations. So what we have done is essentially choose a Milky Way based on its K-band luminosity, so stellar mass, and some measure of environment. And so what stellar mass range should we be looking at? So we ask the question, given a Milky Way, or let's say given a dark matter halo mass of some number, so we just picked something that's typical in the literature, so about 2 times 10 to the 12, what is the range in stellar masses that one would expect in that stellar, in that dark matter halo? So this is Yao's work looking at a pointer. Okay, here we go. So this is K-band luminosity as a proxy for stellar mass. This is halo mass. And just asking, given some amount of scatter, and I forget, I wrote it down, that's good, 0.15 Dexon scatter. For this mass halo, you would expect this range in K-band luminosity. And that's roughly, although slightly larger than the K-band luminosity that people have estimated in the literature for the Milky Way itself. Okay, so in addition, given that stellar mass range, we have some cuts on environment. We don't want to have, we don't want this thing to be living in a cluster. This environment cut, so we ask that there's nothing within the Vero radius of the object that's a... 1 magnitude fainter or brighter, and outside of a massive group. This environment criteria is actually agnostic to the presence of an M31. So M31 is actually 2 Vero radius away from the Milky Way. But we have looked, and we have maybe 10 or 20% that do have M31-like hosts in our main sample. In the results I'm showing today, none of them do, and that may be an interesting part of the story towards the end. So we have this environment cut, and then we have just kind of a practical cut. We don't want this to be right in the middle of the galactic plane. And then there's a distance cut that I will motivate. Okay, so given this definition of the Milky Way, how far out in volume do I need to go in order to get 100 Milky Ways? Okay, so here I'm going to just ask, given all of the galaxies, let's see, whatever this is, given all the galaxies in the universe, how far out in distances? So this is a cumulative number of galaxies. So if I just say all galaxies with absolute luminosities between, in this K-band range, this is a cumulative, cumulative number of galaxies. And if I want to get out to 100 objects, I need to go out to, let's say, 18 megaparsecs. Okay, but no, I actually have an environment cut. And the environment cut obviously gets rid of galaxies, and so now I need to go out to, let's say, 22 or 23 megaparsecs. But then I also have sort of these practical issues. I'd like to be away from the galactic plane. That cuts out a little bit more. And then I also have this distance cut. And so the issue here, actually, let me just show you what that means. There's a distance cut. And then I also need to have photometry that's helpful. And so if my object has to be, let's say, in the SDSS, which 5 years ago was the only available imaging survey we had, that brings us down to having to go out to sort of 30 or 40 megaparsecs. Okay. And so this is our cut. The majority of our hosts are regular NGC galaxies. And this is what a regular NGC galaxy looks like. We'd like to find satellites around this object out to the Vera radius. And the Vera radius at these distances, come on, animation, let's go, is large. So that's the Vera radius. At 20 megaparsecs, the Vera radius of a Milky Way is about a 1 degree. And so we have put a lower limit distance of 20 megaparsecs because surveying over larger degree turns out to be really difficult. And we have instruments that have basically fields of view of 1 degree or so. And so this is well matched to our instrumentation. There's only about 20 Milky Ways given this definition inside of 20 megaparsecs. And so we just decided to cut those out. And so 20 megaparsecs is our lower survey limit. And then our upper survey limit of 40 megaparsecs is also defined by what we can do observationally. We can get down in with the observing resources that we have available, sort of 4 meter class telescopes. We can get spectra down to 21st with some ease, sort of an hour or two integration. And this is equivalent to an absolute luminosity of minus 12.3, the LEO 1. And so that's what sets our survey parameters. So, given that, 1 degree down to 21st, how many galaxies do we have to look at in order to find satellites? And so within 1 degree, there's typically something like 10,000 galaxies within the Vera radius of an object like this. And that's a lot of objects for me to go personally and get spectra of. And so you might just say, Marla, why don't you just use photometric redshifts? This is ridiculous that you're actually doing all this work. And the problem is that photometric redshifts don't work at low redshift. And so in this redshift range, so this is 0.005 to 0.01, here are galaxies that we have spectroscopically confirmed as satellites or low redshift galaxies, and these are confirmed background objects, and you can't tell the difference. Please, you can't tell the difference. It's really hard to tell the difference. Here are the redshift of those objects. And so the problem is that these very low redshift objects look like slightly more luminous, much more numerous galaxies at a little bit higher redshifts. And just to sort of to kill this point, so here are the photometric redshifts versus spectroscopic redshifts. This is for Sloan SDSS. This is Sloan SDSS. Spectroscopic on the... oh, that's good. Spectroscopic redshift on the x-axis, photometric redshift from SDSS DR12 on the y-axis. And things seem to look pretty good, right? There is a correlation. Here is, as a function of R-band magnitude, this is just a fractional error in the photometric redshift. So you want to be near zero. You definitely don't want to be above one. And again, in Sloan, this is doing well. But if I plot low redshift galaxies, you can see where the problem lies. So not only, so we see here the photometric redshift versus spectroscopic. Here as a function of luminosity. You might say, well, this is not quite fair, right? Because Sloan is only trained on objects that are brighter than 17.7 and brighter than the spectroscopic redshift. But you can note that not only are these things neither accurate, they're also sort of, obviously there's a bit of a bias upwards. And the real problem, the killer for us, is we need to be complete. We can't miss a few satellites, given that there are 5 satellites that we expect around the Milky Way. If we miss one, we're screwed. And it's this tail of photometric redshifts up to very, very high redshifts, which means we can't even do any sort of cut on PhotoZs without losing some completeness. And so this is where the problem is, and we need to do to do a lot of spectra to convince ourselves that we have complete luminosity functions. And so what we would like to do is, or survey sort of design was, let's go and get complete luminosity function, complete spectroscopy for a couple of hosts, and then try and design color cuts that are essentially opposite from what everyone else does, is try and do low redshift color cuts. And so that brings us to the work part of the talk. So, you know, with the lack of reliable photoses, we didn't have very many faint satellites to train up something, and so we needed to go out and do this. So we needed large field of view, multi-object spectrographs, and we've done this really just by hook and crook and begging. We've written a lot of observing proposals, and we've had a fair amount of time on MMT, Hectospec, and AAT-2DF, with some time with Magellan IMAX. We, as in I, and like Yao and Eric and sort of Risa, but you know. You don't know how to reduce data, my love. So we have 20,000 redshifts to date. So 20,000 redshifts or 17,000 redshifts below Sloan, thanks. I'll note that there are 300 redshifts that are brighter. That is, Sloan is actually not complete, even in the places where you think Sloan is complete. And I'm happy to chat about that. I really want to note that upcoming spectroscopic surveys like DESI and FORMOS are not going to do this. So DESI main survey is doing BOSS-like color selection, so they're only selecting for high redshift galaxies. They're explicitly color selecting out of this stuff. DESI bright time will get down to about 19th, so it's not as deep as we would like to go. FORMOS, it looks like, we were just looking at this yesterday, it looks like they are actually going to do photo-Z cuts for low redshift, but again, that may not actually be complete, and so we want to go talk to the survey designers and try and convince them that maybe what we were doing is a better idea. So here's what we've done. So this is color, so GR minus R, to RI color for bright objects like Sloan and fainter objects down here. Just to note, the BOSS color selection, these are BOSS galaxies poorly plotted. The BOSS color selection is up in this quadrant in both of these. And if I plot the from our sort of initial survey where we're doing complete color, no color selection whatsoever, here are where low redshift galaxies, very, very low redshift galaxies live. And you'll note they all live within this lower quadrant. And so we're like, all right, that's good. And then we did some semi-analytic modeling. These are coming from colors from Yu Liu, where he simulated the colors of dwarf galaxies in a redshift range at these magnitudes. And for both star-forming and quenched galaxies, you'll note they're both within this color window or this box. And so we defined a low redshift color cut, so based on the just GRI colors and their errors. And this allows us to get rid of about a factor of 2 the number of objects that we need to search for in each one of our hosts. Okay, so these are our GRI color cuts. We think we are complete using these color cuts. And we have now gotten complete spectroscopy within these color cuts, within the Vera radii of 8 Milky Way-like galaxies. And so this is our spectroscopic completeness as a function of apparent magnitude, where we have 82% completeness for at least 8 of these things. And just to kind of point out, so these are those 8 hosts. We actually have 90% completeness for 6 of these hosts. I'll just note, even though I'm not kind of running out of time, that this is early days in the survey. We know sort of personally each one of these galaxies, and so we've named them. And you'll note these are all sagas. And so anyway, so to give you a sense of what we're dealing with, so here is for one of our objects. This is the Vero radius here. Our host is right there. These are all targets, all galaxies brighter than 20 point, or basically brighter than 21. If I do my GRI cut, you'll see it reduces the number of objects, and then you'll see the number of satellites. And so this will go through each one of our hosts. And if you want to look at this in more detail, it's on the website. And this is thanks to Yao for making this like super awesome animation. But just to focus in on one of these objects, or a couple of these objects. So again, here is one of our hosts, the Vero radius. We found 5 or 6 satellites in this, 6 satellites in this host. 3 of them had already been known from SCSS, 3 of them we have found. But what we can say is that there are no other satellites in this Vero radius. And so it's interesting, you know, here you've got a bunch of satellites similar to the Milky Way. Here we only found 2 satellites. We actually only found 1. SDSS had already had 1. But we can say with confidence that there are no other satellites within the Vero radius down to our magnitude limit in this object. I'll talk to you later. You might say, no, maybe there's surface brightness issues spectroscopic issues or something like that. And we've looked into this quite a bit. Here is the projected for the, so for those 8 hosts, assuming that we have complete luminosity functions, here's how we define a satellite. So this is out to the Vera radius, this is a projected distance, and we just do a straight velocity cut, which we think is easier to compare in the simulations. We have 27 satellites around these 8 complete hosts, 14 of which were new. We've also discovered 11 new satellites, an additional 8, but those don't have complete spectroscopy. I'm going to just flash up the luminosity functions. I'm flashing up really quick. So these are the luminosity functions for each individual object. This is the Milky Way in M31. The luminosity functions generally agree. This is an abundance matching. I thought there was details on this. Yeah. Subhalo model based on 50 Milky Way resimulations and simple abundance matching. And what we find is that the luminosity functions, which is in blue with our completeness in sort of gray, compared to the model, they generally agree, but they tend to be more shallow. So they're both a slightly more bright satellites and fewer faint satellites in most cases. And so that's perhaps interesting. The most interesting thing that we have found so far in this, you know, small number of objects is not the luminosity functions, but rather every single one of our satellites, with one exception in our complete sample, is star forming. So I've color-coded our satellites. They're in blue. We have one galaxy which we found was quenched. We could have found quenched galaxies if they were there. So here are the spectra of some of the star-forming objects. And what I want to point out to the spectroscopists, and there's probably like 2 of them in the room, you can in fact see absorption lines in our emission line spectra, meaning that our signal-to-noise is high, and if there was an absorption line quenched galaxy, we would have found it. So in comparison to the Milky Way, which 2 out of the 5 satellites to these magnitudes are star-forming, so that's 40% Magellanic clouds, 26 out of 27 of our satellites are star-forming, so that's 96%, which I think is quite interesting. And not only that, our one quenched galaxy is this dude right here, and it's actually perhaps a satellite is very close to the brightest satellite of the system, so maybe it's a satellite of a satellite. I'll just kind of very quickly, so these are the properties of our satellites, so GRI, surface brightness, and radius. The yellow is the Milky Way. Again, we have one quenched satellite in our main survey. We found one other quenched satellite, but it's below our magnitude limit. It's unlikely that this. So why are we seeing these very quenched very star-forming galaxies? One thing you might say is, well, maybe this is some kind of conformity thing that we're seeing. The thing is that, and that meaning that all of our hosts perhaps are star-forming. That's not quite true. We've not selected on star formation rate of the host. And so this is for the host. This is the stellar mass range of our host. The red are these complete Milky Ways. And this is the star formation rate. And we have a fairly large range where here is the Milky Way. So we have a large range of star formation rates of the host, and yet we're seeing star-forming satellites around all of them. Maybe this is due to our isolation criteria. I said at the beginning of the talk that we don't have M31s anywhere close to these particular hosts. So that might be interesting as we go and get more data and have objects that do have M31s. Perhaps we'll be able to say something there. Okay, going to the future, we have measured or will be measuring masses for all of our satellites. Eric Tollerer is actually at Palomar right now measuring masses. And we will have dynamical masses, we'll have H1 masses for all these, we have Arecibo data for this. This is like duck shooting, it's super easy. We want to achieve 100 Milky Ways, so how are we going to do that? And really we have to think about this in 2 ways. First of all, we need a lot more telescope time, so if there's anyone that has access to MMT or AT, just come talk to us. I'm actually very serious about that. If you want to join, we're looking for people to help us there. But the second one is we need to substantially reduce our candidate target density. Without sacrificing completeness. So we're looking at doing this with deeper imaging, maybe having just better photometric errors will help us. We're looking doing this just using more features, so using the U-band or maybe some other features. And then we're also looking at this from a machine learning algorithm perspective and trying to see if there's something else there that we can use to not sacrifice completeness but still reduce this target density. So I will just flash up my conclusions.
Thank you, Mala. So are you using Sloan photometry to find the target objects?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
So if you put LEO-1 at 30 megaparsecs and just inject it into the Sloan photometry, what's the probability that the pipeline would have found it?
So it would have found it, and we've actually done both actually simulating it into the images, but I'll also show this. So this is taking the properties of the Milky Way satellites and placing them at the distances within our survey. So here's effective radius. LEO-1 is the green thing. So LEO-1 is just right at the edge of our survey at 40 megaparsecs. And in this direction, it gets small. So it's only about an arc second and a half to 2 arc seconds at the edge of our survey. But it would have been resolved by SDSS. It's on the right on the edge.
So you don't hit I was worried about the surface brightness limits. You don't hit
so
that.
So surface brightness, we're actually not bad there. So the surface brightness of LEO-1 is still within the places where I trust Sloan. And we've also compared... we have overlapping regions between Sloan and DECCAM decals. And we're not finding, that was one of the slides I skipped, we're not finding that there are tons of low surface brightness things that decals is finding that SDSS is not.
So as you said, most of the satellites are star forming. What about their morphologies? How do they look?
What about their morphologies? They look pretty. I mean, I would suggest, so we've measured radius, the radiuses are all there. They look kind of like normal dwarfs in the field, kind of
like
bursty.
Like an SMC.
Yeah, I mean, so, I'm sorry, these are our, if you go to the SAGA survey website, you'll just see a montage of all the satellites that we've found so far. There's nothing there that jumps out at me.
So given the, once you have the spectra, you make a cut on the line of sight velocity difference with respect to the host.
Yeah.
So what cut do you use, and have you guys done mock tests to see what fraction of these things might be actually be interlopers?
That's a great question. So looking at that plot, let me just pull it out because I think it's informative. So we're using 250 kilometers a second. And so I think one thing that's interesting, so have we done tests looking at interlopers? We have. But what I think is particularly interesting is you'll know, and these are all of the things that we have spectra for within the Vireo radar projected in. So it's complete within, inside of this dashed line. And we do not see any satellites, right, between 250 and 500 kilometers of either the caustics or of our cuts. And so that leads me to believe that, first of all, we have halos that maybe are close to the same masses, and that we don't have a large fraction of interlopers. Otherwise, I would expect to have seen more objects there. And again, part of it is just because these things are actually quite nearby, and so they're huge in the sky. Yeah. And we made, yeah, exactly.
You mentioned that you would planning to use U-band in the future. I'm just curious, what's wrong with the SDSS U-band? Why haven't you used it so far?
So we are using the SDSS U-band. That's kind of the next step. It only reduces our target density by about 20% further. And the problem is that U-band in SDSS is noisy. And so if there was higher signal-to-noise U-band imaging, I think that could actually help us substantially.
And
These things are, galaxies pretty shallow, and so we want to make sure that we're looking at objects that are 21st magnitude. Galaxy isn't going to find all of those.
And quickly, what's the density of these objects on the sky? Like, what area do you need to find 100 of them?
I'm not quite sure I understand your question.
200 over the whole sky.
Right.
200 Milky Way analogs over the whole sky.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So Mala, while Carlos sets up, the takeaway that I'm getting from your work is that the Milky Way is average.
Well, yes and no. I mean, so it's the star-forming properties, I think, that is
right.
Really interesting.
But
so if we're taking away things about how satellites quench, I think that's, potentially a problem. In terms of the numbers, we've looked at things like satellite planes and, is there any correlations? We just don't have the numbers yet to say something that I think is, we don't have the numbers to say anything statistical yet.
Thank you.
It's slight, it's at the high end, but it's in there. Yes, and we certainly have done that. We have done that, yeah, for sure.
Let's thank Marla again.